Let's get booze off of television. I know that'll make me a lot of friends in some areas of the country. But in 1984, we spent $60 billion on booze. But we had alcohol-related problems of $120.8 billion. For every dollar we take in taxes, our society, that's you and me, we're spending nearly $10 for societal-related problems because of the booze. Here's a frightening part. There are 16 million problem drinkers in America today, and 3 million of them are teenagers. I got to studying this some 15 years ago. 15 years ago, one person in 15 who took a casual drink ended up with a drinking problem. Today, one person in 7 who takes a casual drink will end up with a drinking problem. Drinking is no longer just socially acceptable, it is socially demanded. You're expected to have it wherever you go. 15 times out of 16, when booze is offered on television, it is accepted. We need to take it off television, the advertising. We need to increase the tax 25%. That would bring in an extra $15 billions. You might say, but Ziegler, don't you want people to have any fun? Well, we've got 20 million adult children of alcoholics. They're not having much fun as a result of being raised in an alcoholic family in most cases. We have 16 million problem drinkers. They are certainly not having any fun. We have 15 million minor children of problem drinkers. And when you put all of that together, it's horrendous. 90% of wife abuse is directly traced to alcohol abuse. They're not having any fun. 70% of our divorces come because partially of drinking. They're not having any fun. 50% of our highway deaths are because of drinking. That's no fun. And 50% of the people who are under the care of a professional are there because of drinking. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a problem. We need to get involved in the political process. We need to study the issues, find out what candidates believe. Not that politician is not what we're going to be saying anymore. That's not the mayor. He is my mayor. He is my congressman. He is my senator. He is my president. We need to take responsibility by putting the right ones in there. Each American needs to study to be informed, to stand up to be counted. We need to sound off to be heard and go to work to make a great America even greater. Now I'd like to take you on a trip to give you an overview of this great land of ours. Over the years, it's been my privilege to have seen this land from every different angle, I do believe. A lot of people never really have that privilege. I would like to take you on a fast trip around America, and I would like to introduce you to some of the really outstanding people who really epitomize what this land is all about. We want to start here in Dallas because we have two of the most remarkable Americans who've ever lived right here in Dallas. One is no longer with us. Her name is Mary Crowley. The other one is Mary Kay. Both of these ladies started and built monumental businesses, each doing in excess of $500 million worth of business a year. They founded them on the basis of, we're going to put God first, family second, and the company is going to be third. What a marvelous concept to build a business on. The other one, of course, is Ross Perot, and his story, of course, is absolutely legendary. He came driving an old used Plymouth with his possessions in the back seat of his car right here in town. And of course, today we know that Mr. Perot is worth not only hundreds of millions of dollars, but well over $1 billion as well. But I want us to kind of hit all of the country. Let's get aboard our jet and fly up to New York City. I have a good friend up there. His name is Jim Giordano. Jim Giordano was a young fella who won a scholarship to Harvard from that New York City public school. No member of his family had ever been into college. He did so well that he got into med school, but after a couple of years of med school, he realized that wasn't for him, and he got interested in free enterprise and what it would really mean to him, and so he started seeking employment on Wall Street. And though he was a college graduate from Harvard University, it still took him 6 months to get a job with Merrill Lynch. They said that we'll only give you a job as a runner. That's $300 a week. Don't expect to be a broker for at least 2 years. 8 months later, he was a broker. 5 years later, he is the managing director and the youngest man at age 25 of a Wall Street brokerage firm. It's Blair & Company, a very wealthy young man at his age. See, that's what America really does afford, is a unique opportunity. Super Bowl Sunday this year was a red-letter day for many of us. We watched two fine teams. Dan Reeves is a friend of mine. Joe Gibbs is a man whom I admire enormously. I watched those teams square off, and I said to myself, well, one thing about it, the good team is going to win today. And it didn't matter which one it was. But as the game progressed and the full impact of what Doug Williams was doing and what it would mean to him and what it would mean to so many of his fans, and watching him perform so coolly under fire as he put to rest forever and ever the myth that the black quarterback has no place in the NFL. What a beacon of light that was, and how exciting it was. That's what America is all about. Get aboard the jet with me. Let's fly south. Let's go into Castleberry, Florida. It's just outside of Orlando. I'd like to introduce you to a fellow. His name is Ted Endicott. In 1987, Ted was the number one salesman for General Motors Automobiles, made in excess of $125,000. He sells an average of over 40 cars a month. He specializes in the soft sell. He doesn't try to overload somebody. If he can see they can't make $300 a month payments, he tries to talk them down, and frequently does talk them down into a model which they can afford. One thing I neglected to mention, Ted Endicott is blind. See, in America, ladies and gentlemen, we are rewarded on our results. Now, I don't know how tall or short or fat or slim or skin color or whether we're male or female. That's what I like about our land. Let's go westward. We're going to stop in Pensacola just for a moment. We'll go by Elkanah Street, and there's a home, I believe it's still standing. It's where Chappie James was raised. But I really want to talk about Chappie's mother, who was a school teacher. In those days when the schools were segregated, the black schools were simply so inferior that she wanted her children and the neighborhood children to have a good education. So for a nickel a day, she taught them school. But she taught them a whole lot more than that. She taught the qualities that we've been talking about. She said to her school kids, including her son Chappie, that you need to have your bags packed and ready to go. And when the door of opportunity swings open, you are ready with your bag to go through that door. Incidentally, General Chappie James, 4-star general, was head of the North American Air Defense Command, the first black 4-star general in our country's history. That's America. Let's leave there and fly over New Orleans. You know, it was in New Orleans that we first gained respect as a national power, when Andrew Jackson and his coonskin boys from the hills of Tennessee defeated the British there. Oh, it was quite an occasion. Get aboard the aircraft again. We're going to see more of the land. We head westward. We're going to fly right over Phoenix, Arizona. In Phoenix, Arizona, really, it's in the adjoining town there of Scottsdale. We're not going to stop, but let me tell you about a young student in school there. Her name is Laurie Cox. It was several years ago, and Laurie one day had the incredible idea that students in school ought to be pledging allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. She went to her teacher, and the teacher thought Laurie was some kind of a nut. She said, Laurie, that's old-fashioned. People don't do stuff like that anymore. She went to the principal, and the principal thought she was out of her mind. She told her boyfriend about it, and the boyfriend said, Laurie, you persist in this insane idea, and you and I are through. Her classmates, some of them friends, quote, turned their back on Laurie. But Laurie had an idea. She had an obsession. She had a belief that people who were saluting the flag and giving the Pledge of Allegiance now would never be burning the flag later on. She started collecting signatures, and over 3,000 students signed their names and said, we would like the privilege of saying the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And today at Coronado High School in Scottsdale, Arizona, that's exactly what they do. Because one young girl knew that she could make a difference. That's what we need to be teaching in our America today. We're going to leave Arizona. I want to go on out to Anaheim, California. I have the privilege of introducing you to a good friend of mine. His name is Carl Karcher. Now, Carl is a gentle giant of a fellow. He's about 6 feet, 6 or 7 inches tall. He weighs about 240 pounds. And Carl Karcher bet on himself and the free enterprise system by pledging his financial net worth to get the capital investment necessary to become an entrepreneur. Now, that means he honked his 41-model Plymouth for $326. And he opened a rolling hot dog stand on the streets of Los Angeles, California many years ago. Today, Carl Karcher is a most unusual man. He has Carl's Jr.'s restaurants all over the place, 440 of them. They have over 13,000 people affiliated with him. Carl Karcher and his wife, Margaret, are now celebrating their 49th year of marriage. They have 12 kids. They have 42 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. Worth many, many millions of dollars, he started with a $326 investment. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what America is all about. Let's go northward. Let's turn up, and we want to just simply fly over some of the giant sequoias in Northern California. What an amazing sight they present from the air. And I hope you've noticed the lush countryside all over the place. I hope you've noticed the grandeur of the mountains, the rivers, and the valleys. What a beautiful land America is. We go north from there over the state of Wyoming. In Wyoming, there is one county which has more known coal reserves that will supply more energy than all of the known oil reserves all over America. One county with that kind of reserves. Dr. Billy Ray Cox was 100% right when he said, lack of resources is not our problem. It is lack of resourcefulness that is making the difference. And we flat have got the resources, and we're developing that resourcefulness. Let's go back eastward. Let's fly over Kansas and Nebraska and the Dakotas. Let's look at Iowa and Illinois, the breadbasket of the world, because we are the land that feeds so many of the others. The best farmland and the best farmers in the whole world. We want to stop in Detroit. I had a privilege a few years ago of meeting a lady. Her name was Ilona Zimmerman. She was recognized as the number one real estate salesperson in the entire metropolitan Detroit area. When I talked with her, I could scarcely understand what she was saying because she was from Hungary. She had escaped from her native land at night when the communists overran it. Living on roots and berries, she made her way out of that land, and when she got to Detroit, she still carried that guttural accent. But she was enormously successful because she never thought about selling a house on a piece of land. She always was selling a home on a little piece of the greatest land on the face of this earth. Oh, what a privilege it is to be an American. Let's come south and fly over the town of Nashville, Tennessee. Man who publishes some of my books, Sam Moore, is a publisher there. Many years ago, he came here from Lebanon. When he first arrived, he got a job working in a grocery store at night, working in a service station during the day, pumping gasoline, knocking bugs off windshields in the days when service stations were service stations. Today, he's the largest publisher of Bibles in the world and a very successful book publisher. We're going to leave Nashville, Tennessee. I want us to go down to Montgomery, Alabama. That's where so much of our history really has taken place in the last 25 or 30 years. It was in Montgomery, Alabama, that one day a black lady got on a bus and her feet hurt. The bus driver said to her, "You sit in the back." She had seated herself up front. She simply said, "My feet hurt." The bus driver said, "You'll have to get up and go to the back." She refused to get up and move back. And that's when an entire people stood up and moved forward. That's where Martin Luther King's civil rights movement really got its start, was with that black lady who refused to get up and move. One person, ladies and gentlemen, can make a dramatic difference in our society. Don't ever sell yourself short. You are important. You are somebody. We're going to make a final stop down in Waco, Texas. I wish we could have gotten there earlier. I would love to have introduced you to my friend Braz Walker, one of the most remarkable men I think I've ever known. When Braz was 19, he was stricken with bulbar polio. And from that time until his death just a few years ago, he was flat of his back with a mechanical breathing device. The only part of his body that he could move was literally his tongue. General Motors rigged for him a special device so that he could type with his tongue and so he could take photographs by having the bulb in his mouth and his associate maneuvering him in position. He published several books, did a lot of writing and lecturing, earned at that time $30,000 to $40,000 a year, despite the fact that all he could move literally was his tongue. In talking with Braz the last time I saw him, I kind of said to him, "Braz, how you doing?" "Oh, Ziggy," said, "man, I'm doing good." Now, he said, "there's no doubt I'd like to be out of here and about like everybody else." But he said, "I know that's never going to happen." But he said, "you know, Zig, I am just so grateful that I was born at the time I was to the only parents, baby, in this country who would have had the patience to have dealt with me as they have. In the only country on the face of this earth where my life would have been possible, and certainly the only one where I could be self-supporting and maintain my dignity as I have." Now, he said, "I know, Zig, that a lot of people look at me and they figure, well, now, if he can do all of those things with the handicaps he has, surely I can do more." You see, Braz Walker never looked down and said, "this I don't have." He kept looking up and saying, "this I do have." I close with what John F. Kennedy would have said had it not been for that fateful day in Dallas. Here was part of the speech he was going to make. "We in this country, in this generation, are by destiny rather than by choice the watchmen of the walls of world freedom. We ask, therefore, that we may be worthy of the power and the responsibility, that we may exercise our strength with wisdom and restraint, that we may achieve in our time and for all times the ancient vision of peace on earth, goodwill toward men. That must always be our goal, and the righteousness of our call must always underlie our strength. For as it was written long ago, except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain." America's a magnificent land, ladies and gentlemen. It's still the land of the free. It's still the home of the brave. It's still the land where any boy or any girl can start from ground zero and using the opportunities that free enterprise offers and using the principles we've been sharing with you, they can start from where they are and accomplish some incredible objectives. We have a tremendous responsibility as adults to make certain that we pass on to the next generation the same opportunity that we have. Let's keep America free and strong. Because if you do, and only if you do, will I be able to say, if you do those things, I'll see you. And yes, I really do mean you at the top. Thank you, and God bless you. Thank you.